From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We continue spending both hours of today's program on the death of Daniel Prude in Rochester police custody. If you are just joining us, you probably know by now the incident happened on March 23rd in the early morning hours, a very cold and snowy night. Daniel Prude eventually died days later. And now an investigation happening at the state level, the Attorney General's office. Also internally, Mayor Warren says she was disturbed when she saw the video and learned of this incident months ago, but says that she had to keep it quiet because the state Attorney General's office is conducting their own investigation. She says it was not a cover-up, and that's exactly what the police chief, Laurent Singletary, said this was not a cover-up. They just didn't feel that they could let the public know that this had happened. We've spoken to numerous attorneys in various offices. They disagree with the statement from the mayor, and they say that she could have said something, but the mayor says that Corporation Counsel for the City of Rochester said that she could not, and she was sticking with that. So this hour, a conversation about reform in a different way. The mayor also said yesterday that it's appropriate for the state attorney general's office to be reviewing this case because she said it would be an insult to the Prude family if police were just investigating themselves here. That very premise is at the heart of the calls for a police accountability board. That movement led to the ballot box, and Rochester, by a large margin, supported a police accountability board. But so far, that board has not been given disciplinary power. That was held up in court, and a judge determined that, at least for now, there's not disciplinary power. The question becomes, what is the extent of the power of the police accountability board to make change? Now, what we know from conversations earlier this summer is that the board is not just there to discipline. The board is there to lead calls for reform, examine how the department is working or not working, how it could improve. But on these matters of investigating individual cases, does the board need to have that power to discipline? And could this case tip the scales a bit back in that direction? Mayor Lovely Warren has not supported giving the Police Accountability Board disciplinary power. The police union, the Locust Club, has not supported giving the Police Accountability Board disciplinary power. Let's see if that could change. Shawnee Wilson is the chair of the board and one of our guests with us this hour. Shawnee, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also, Rabbi Dror Settle, who is part of the board, is with us. Rabbi, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for coming back.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Danielle Tucker is also with the board and is with us now. Danielle, thanks for making the time.
Thank you for having me.
And our thanks to our colleague Gino Finelli, who's with us on the line, who produced a piece that I think everyone ought to be reading. And that piece is in City Newspaper Today, 50 Years of Rochester Police Reform Yielded Few Returns. Gino, welcome. Thanks for writing the piece. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Gino, this piece drops today. That's journalistic parlance. It drops today. It's published today. Mm-hmm. On one of the most painful and difficult times for our city when it comes to police-community relations in a lifetime. So it is remarkable that your work would have coincided with this. But here we are. How important do you think it is for Rochesterians to understand that some of the reforms, short of a PAB, I mean, the PAB is very different than I think what you're talking about in the piece, but some of the reforms that have been proposed, it sort of feels like everything old is new again, with the exception of the PAB. There's so much that has already been tried for, 50 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first instance we saw this that the piece outlines was in 1975 after the shooting of Denise Hawkins. And most of the recommendations, there was 97 recommendations made by a committee that was put together to address changing policing, reforming policing. And they are eerily similar to what we're talking about today. And many of those changes were 85 of the 97 were adopted by city council, at least on paper. But in practice, many of these reforms just were often lip service in a way. They didn't actually make a substantive change in how policing was done, what the core way of looking at policing was. And some of those things were related to mental health calls, and that those were could have played a role in the death of Daniel Prude. But we're talking about the same things today. And the PAB is, in a way, kind of a child of what happened back in 1975 when they added the first civilian to an overview committee that looked at police misconduct. And then we saw the Civilian Review Board and now the PAB, which is a more strengthened version of that. But we see these incremental steps in police reform that have happened over the years. And the question is, have they had an actual impact? And when we see these instances still happening, it is a worthwhile question to ask, and knowing the history behind it and what we can do to move forward.
Gino, last hour, Danielle Ponder on this program said that she is, quote, done with reform. What she means by that, she explained, is not that she doesn't want change. She doesn't want the nickel and dime proposals that we've seen for 50 years that you detail in your piece, because she says it hasn't borne any fruit. That the headlines we see in 1972 and 1984 and 2018 and 2020 look too similar given the urgency of the problem. And so her feeling is that there needs to be serious, substantive, significant, and wholesale change in reimagining what we expect of police, how we discipline police when things go wrong, etc. Is that an important part of the perspective that you're perhaps trying to ask the community to consider, that when we look at these reforms, to be very careful with thinking that even if intentions are good, that large change, the deep, meaningful change is likely to come?
Yeah, and I have spoke with Danielle for this piece, and she had mentioned pretty much the same thing, that prior to George Floyd's death, she would consider herself a reformist, but now isn't. And this is something we've seen a ton of, and I don't think it's my question to necessarily act, but from activists that are asking, advocates that are asking, saying things like defund the police and what that actually means. And I think it's at kind of a position where we need to look at these incremental steps, these small steps that happen, these tweaks to the system. Are they addressing the root of the problem? And historically, what we're seeing now is that these cases haven't stopped. They're still happening. We've taken these incremental steps, and they are still occurring. So I think it is reasonable for people to ask the question, is reform as incremental steps, as changes to the system, actually going to have fruitful results if the system itself relatively remains the same structure in and of itself? And we have plenty of records, and again, I defer back to the piece I wrote, that show that even when we make these changes, the core root of the problem doesn't really disappear. The core discrepancies that happen don't actually just go away. There's something larger happening there, and I think we have the RAISE Commission that is going right now, and I think one of the questions they're trying to tackle is, what is the cause of the root of those problems, and how do we weed them out? Mm.
If you can hang here for a bit longer, Gino, I'd like to circle back, because there's a couple of quotes in there that I think need to be heard by our audience. If they haven't read the piece yet, they are frankly chilling, but they are part of our history, and I think they need to be contextualized. So if you can hang here for a bit, we're going to circle back to that in just a second. I want to ask the members of the Police Accountability Board, Shawnee, I'll start with you as the chair. I suspect you may be somewhat limited in what you can say specifically about the Prude case, but I do want to give you the chance to, frankly, make some remarks, anything that you feel is appropriate as we think about the loss of Daniel Prude, his family, and what the community is going through. Go ahead, Shawnee.
Sure. So I'll say, you know, first off, that, you know, we are just, you know, I can say this for the rest of the board, that we are just so profoundly sorry and so, you know, sick with what happened. You know, I think especially, you know, with just wandering around all summer and having to deal with, you know, crisis after crisis and death after death, it just, you know, it's so much, you know, it's so much more far removed, right, when it's not, you know, from around here. But, you know, when you have been, you know, I think we took it especially hard as a board because, you know, we have been, you know, working so hard to actually, you know, talk and do these changes that, you know, Gino addresses in his article, and to see that we have still so much work to do is discouraging. But, you know, I guess the thing that I will just say is that, you know, the family has our thoughts and our prayers, and just which I know is kind of, you know, I know that that's like thoughts and prayers, but when you actually really are praying and thinking of people, especially people that look like you, I guess that's what I'll say first off.
Yeah, and I'll turn to your colleagues in a moment here, Shani, but I also think it's pertinent to ask you, when did you find out about the death of Daniel Prude?
So I found out about the death of Daniel Prude the same time that everybody else did. I think that, you know, I turned on the news and saw the...
Yesterday?
And saw the press conference. So, yes, it was confirmed to me yesterday.
You are the chair of the Police Accountability Board, and you did not know about this. I mean, that is surprising to me. Do you have a problem with that?
Oh, I most certainly do, yes. But again, I mean, these, you know, the question remains, you know, we don't have our executive director yet. And so if we don't have all of our pillars in place at this time, you know, I think that things get past us a lot easier. And so, you know, or people can make excuses as to why we shouldn't know things or why we shouldn't have information. And so, you know, I think that is, you know, just to circle back, that is why the reinstating of our disciplinary power oversight and going after policies and procedures are so important, because this issue and issues like these are why we need to exist. That is why we are here.
The mayor has said that she wanted to let the community know and wanted to be transparent about this, but she didn't feel that she could because of an executive order. And as I said last hour, we've spoken with numerous attorneys in various offices. Not a single one of them agrees with the mayor's analysis of that. They said there's no reason the mayor couldn't have been forthright with the public and let the public know about this earlier. Do you accept the mayor's claim that she just couldn't have told you or told the public about this case?
You know, I've been talking about this with our other board members, and, you know, I don't have any insight as to how and why the mayor decided to not share that information. I only know that even with an ongoing attorney general's information and the advice that she received from corporate counsel, I question that judgment, but I don't have enough information to actually say what's right or wrong here. I mean, I most necessarily, like, I'd be asking some questions of counsel, and I'd be asking some questions as to why that was done. So
what would you ask the mayor?
So I would ask the mayor, if she took that corporate counsel advice, you know, was that the wisest decision to make? You know, had she, like, who had she spoken to about it? And, you know, quite frankly, you know, if that was a case of misconduct that was coming to you, then, you know, I would just want to know in depth, what were the chain of decisions that you made to lead you to this outcome today? And would you have made a different choice?
Okay. And I am curious to know, Shani, when you heard the mayor on June 10th, let's listen again to what the mayor said back on June 10th, just 2 weeks after the killing of George Floyd, when the calls for reform were happening in cities across the country, including Rochester. The mayor told our community that, you know, it's not perfect, but we are in such better shape than most cities. That stuff doesn't happen here. Let's listen to the mayor on June 10th.
I know that there is work that needs to continue to happen. So I think that we have to understand that we have challenges, and we are able and always willing to improve. A lot of the things that other cities are facing right now, we have already done in Rochester. Nothing happens in a vacuum, but I can tell you that by light years, Rochester is ahead of the curve, and we will continue to do what is necessary to make sure that our community feels safe, and our officers feel safe, and that we can work in partnership to uplift our entire community together.
Was that an appropriate set of comments to make, knowing that Daniel Prude's death was not public, but she knew about that, Shani?
No, it was not. It was not. Okay. And again, I also would like to know, that is my personal opinion, I would like to know in depth, and hopefully maybe she will discuss that further, but why, what was the chain of decisions that led you to the decision that you made? And knowing what you know now, would you have stuck by that decision? Because I think that's what all of us would like to know.
Okay. Let me turn to your colleagues, and as I do that, we just got word that the Rochester Police Locust Club has put out its first statement. They declined to comment on the Daniel Prude case last night, but here is the statement in totality. I will read the full statement from the Rochester Police Locust Club, the police union. Quote, "The Rochester Police Locust Club has concerns about the incident involving our members and Mr. Daniel Prude. We are in the process of gathering all relevant information available to us, and we will issue a statement when that is completed." End quote. End statement. That is close to saying nothing at all. I mean, Daniel Prude has been dead for more than 5 months, not 5 days. It is unclear to me what information we're still gathering, but perhaps Mike Mazzeo and the Locust Club will elaborate on that. They did not offer condolences to the Prude family, by the way. Danielle Tucker, do you find this case to be a potential tipping point in the debate about what responsibilities the Police Accountability Board has regarding handling of cases and discipline?
Do I find it to be a tipping point? I find this case to affirm why it's so important that the Police Accountability Board had the statute of the disciplinary power. Just based off everything that has happened, we just learned about this case, but after listening to the conference on yesterday from the mayor and the community, we understand why it's so very important that the PAB is needed. I think this case is heartbreaking. It's sickening. I just got to extend my condolences to the family. But this case makes it extremely clear for the community of why the Police Accountability Board is needed and why the police needs to be held accountable.
Rabbi Settle, how do you see it?
So I think that it is a tipping point in that part of our national discussion now about these issues has been that for many of us, we grew up with a certain story about who we were and how our history happened. And I think part of the story that Rochester's been telling itself for whatever reason is, as bad as it is, the worst isn't happening here. And we have to really change the story now. And I think that that's enormously important. And of course, there are many people in this community, particularly Black and Brown people, who knew what the real story was. But I think that we really have to open up that acknowledgement to the larger community. So in that sense, yes, I see it as a tipping point. And if I could comment on one other thing, I know you didn't ask this, but about the PAB, about this weird situation we're in as a PAB that doesn't, people don't think we're doing anything, and we're doing a lot to get everything going. But not only was no one aware of this incident, but for instance, RACE is now setting up a policing committee as part of its work, and no one from the PAB has been included in that. So I think that there's this odd sort of lack of awareness of our presence that it's really important that we counter.
I should ask the chair as well. Shawnee Wilson, do you see this particular case as having any impact on the debate legally or even in the public discourse about what the PAB ought to be able to do with disciplinary power?
So I think it affirms the fact, just like some of my colleagues were saying, mm-hmm. that we need disciplinary oversight and subpoena power. I do believe that this confirms that there are gaps in the perception of what safety means here in Rochester. I think that some of the police have a very different view of what safety means, and I think that the citizens also have real ground experience as to what that means. So I think that, you know, do I think that it will change the outcome of the case? We won't know until the case is heard, right? But I don't, but I think that on, especially in the public discourse, that I think it actually really, unfortunately, confirms what we have seen in recent years, and actually also confirmed by Gino's article.
And there's something that the mayor said yesterday that I want to also ask you about, Shani, in regards to who investigates police. The mayor said that the Attorney General's office is handling an investigation, the state Attorney General's office. Tish James, Attorney General James, put out a statement last night saying that there will be transparency and that, you know, they offered sympathy for the Prude family. The mayor said that it would be insulting to the Prude family if RPD was investigating RPD on this case, and that it was appropriate to have the state Attorney General's office investigating. That to me is roughly the same argument that advocates for the PAB having disciplinary power have said all along here. But I'm curious to know if there is, you know, a needle to thread. And what I mean by that is there an argument that, because the mayor has said she supported a PAB to an extent, but didn't want disciplinary power. Could the mayor make the argument that, well, look, in cases where someone dies in police custody, then you need an outside investigation, and that's what the AG's office is for. You don't need disciplinary power with the PAB for day-to-day, week-to-week cases. In the relatively rare events when someone dies in police custody, that's different, and we already have that with the state attorney general's office stepping in there. Does that argument hold water with you, Shani?
So that's a really interesting point. I think that, you know, I'm actually not sure how that would work. I actually would love to see us work. You know, the AG has their own investigation, and just like, you know, just on the ground level, right? If you have the citizen, like the now Citizens Review Board that is now standing, plus you have the internal investigation that is performed by, you know, the police. So I would hope that we would be able to still have disciplinary, that our disciplinary oversight and our subpoena power would be honored by the Attorney General, since they are conducting an independent organization or investigation, but that should not have any bearing on the case that we're hearing, right? Because, you know, they're at the state level and we are at the city level. So I guess I don't see how that would really hold much water.
Okay.
I mean, but yeah. That's just my thoughts.
Danielle Tucker, when the mayor said that, you know, it's appropriate to have the state AG, does that make sense to you in cases like this? And do you think that is enough? How did you see that statement?
I saw this statement very similar to what Shani said. It was catching to my ear when the mayor stated that it wouldn't make sense for the Rochester Police Department to investigate the Rochester Police Department on a case such as this, but she did believe in the AG. However, I do believe we do need the PAB simply because we're on the ground, we're here, we're in the community, we're able to get things done effectively and more efficiently as well. And we're part of the community. So that's how I see it.
Okay. And Rabbi, what do you think?
So I think that absolutely when I heard the mayor say that, I thought, right, exactly, you get it. The police shouldn't be investigating the police. And while death, of course, is a, you know, irrevocable harm, I think that discounts the other real harms. To say that only, you know, there should only be disciplinary outside review for death discounts the reality of the tremendous harms that members of the community have felt at the hands of police. And that, okay, you know, you might not have killed someone, but if you injured them, if you affected their livelihood, if you, who knows, you know, what this is about, but those are also, we need to take those harms seriously as well and not take death as the only standard of injury.
Well, let me turn back to Gino Finelli, our colleague from City Newspaper, whose piece in City Today, 50 years of Rochester police reform yielded few returns. I remember interviewing and talking to Ron Evangelista, who was the head of the Rochester Police Locust Club before Mike Mazzeo was. He was always sort of a brash quote, but, you know, what he said in 1984 that you quoted in your piece is beyond what I remember Ron having said in the past. Gino, I'm going to go ahead and quote from your piece, and we're going to talk a little bit about this because, I mean, it's shocking, but people need to hear this. You write the following. Ronald Evangelista, when it came to police reform, was the head of the Locust Club before Mike Mazzeo. In a 2005 op-ed in the Democrat and Chronicle, Evangelista called Bill Johnson's Pathways program hypocrisy at its finest and denounced recommendations like placing cameras in police cars. Asked during a wide-ranging interview with the Democrat and Chronicle in 1984 about tensions between police and communities of color, Evangelista grew indignant. "You haven't figured it out yet," he said. "You haven't figured out why? The answer to the question, and no one ever wants to say it, is because black people are responsible for most of the street crime in this country. And by having a black leader getting up and supporting black people, he's supporting his type of people. That's very popular. Minorities, not just blacks, are not popular with police, who are mostly white, middle-class people." End quote. And the interviewer from the DNC said, "Is there any way to change that?" Evangelista responded, "Go tell the black leaders to promote education instead of police mistrust." End quote. Gino, what went through your mind when you're digging through archives and reading up on police reform efforts and you came across that quote?
Well, frankly, it's a harsh thing to read. It's remarkably crass, and coming from a person who had a really high level of authority when it came to policing, the highest level in the city, you could argue that the police union president has more power than the chief themselves when it comes to how policing operates. It is shocking. But is it really shocking is the question.
Unfortunately, because, you're right. That's right. So go ahead.
We see this happening over and over and over, and when we're seeing it happening right now. If you can go on Twitter and read through how people are talking about protests and, you know, how they talk about people that have been victimized by the police and the way they phrase it, it might be different than the way Evangelista talked about it back then, but it's the same exact rhetoric, that it's never the people in uniform's fault. It's always the community's fault. It's always the people that are being victimized's fault. And that is something that has not changed. It simply hasn't. And it's a core piece of philosophy that's kind of existed throughout all of these attempts to reform, that there is this certain subset of people who believe that the police are always on the right side of things. I don't want to ever argue that there are no good police. There are absolutely good police. But there are a certain subset of people that will vindicate them at any cost to say that the community themselves are the problem. The people that are being policed are the problem. So that's something that the quote from Evangelista is terrifying. It was terrifying in 1984, and it's terrifying today. But it is not something new, and it's not something that's gone away either.
He said that black people are not popular with police, who are mostly white middle-class people. That is what Ron Evangelista said in 1984. And to Gino's point, though, it's shocking, but is it that shocking? Is it that different? That's not to say that's the heart of every police officer, and we understand that. But Pew Research, the latest Pew data, 91% of white American police officers think that we've done enough for racial equality in this country and we should move on. That is 35 points more than the national average of white people and more than around 40 points more than the national average, period. So white American police officers are massively out of step on race. And what Ron Evangelista said in 1984, even if it chills us today, Shawnee, is it that different? I mean, I want to be careful here because to Gino's point here, mm-hmm. I don't want to do this, you know, this dance where you go, well, you know, not all cops, but it doesn't take it doesn't take all cops. And what Evangelista said in 1984 should have been disqualifying then. I wonder how it feels today to you, Shawnee.
Well, you know, I know the last discussion I had with you that we talked about, you know, like a barrel of bad apples, right? I mean, when you have just a few apples, it will affect the rest of the bunch. And, you know, it doesn't have to be all blight and disease, right, of these apples, but the fact is every single apple in that barrel is changed. And, you know, that is where, when we come to the factor, it's like there's no good or bad, people just are.
You know, I might have a good day, I might have a bad day. That means that I'm a person, and a person still has to be responsible for the actions of what they do. You know, my thing is that, you know, we're seeing, like I said before to you, that we're seeing these the same type of disregard for humanity. We're seeing the same just a lack of just completely disregarding the training that they've received. Like those are the types of things that are systemic and across the board from multiple areas of policing within this country. So it's not a good or bad thing. There's just a lot going on that we have to address, I believe.
Rabbi Settle, when you hear 1984's the comment from Ron Evangelista in 1984, do you think that was then, or do you think that's far too close to where we are today?
So this morning I was listening to the Daily Podcast by the New York Times from last Monday, where a police officer named Scott Watson, who's an African-American police officer, was talking about that experience of those attitudes within the department on him as a black police officer. It's a very powerful testimony and podcast. And I think that, you know, as someone who's engaged in counseling, I often sort of think of this joke of how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. And that phrase, the light bulb has to want to change, is very much about feeling right now, and that I know police feel that their experience is not recognized or understood, and I hope that, you know, in this process they'll come to the table and tell us what they think we need to know. But on some level, as long as the story they're telling themselves is nothing needs to change, and as the reporter said, so Greg, I think, you know, that the black and white, so to speak, of who's in the wrong and who's in the right, I don't know how we get to what really has to happen, because rules don't change culture, right? You can have all the policies and procedures and everything else. I know from personal experience elsewhere that you can do training, but if the officers there think it's a joke, they'll sit and joke, right? And that there's a much deeper process that has to happen where these things are inculcated and consistently put in as reflexes. So if you want to do de-escalation, for instance, right, it can't be a training. It has to be a total ongoing practice in the same way that my son's an EMT. And, you know, when he did his exam, he couldn't think twice about what he had to do in a specific occasion or a specific emergency. It had to be so ingrained in him that it just come, you know, that's just what he does. Right. So when we're talking about that kind of really deep commitment, you know, it's, again, that's not going to be solved by policy procedures, right? That's really about a deeper process of transformation of culture and engagement.
Danielle Tucker, what goes through your mind when you hear that 1984 quote from Evangelista?
That the quote in itself, it's really heartbreaking. It's even more scary to see where we are today and to read a quote like that from 1984, you said? It to be a quote from 1984 and for us to be fighting and still fighting the same issues in 2020. I just ask the question of how far have we come? How much further do we, you know, how much harder do we need to fight if we're kind of still dealing with the same mentality? It hits very close to home, especially when we have incidents like George Floyd and incidents like Daniel Prude and a countless of other individuals. It really hits close to home. It really makes me think, you know, has it been changed? You know, what more do we need to do?
Mm-hmm. Gino Finelli, I got to let you go. I know you're always working. What's on the plate for the rest of the day here? Where do you go next with your reporting on this, Gino?
Well, I've had to file some FOIL requests for some files that I'll keep a mystery right now. But there's some investigative work that needs to be done around the Daniel Prude case that I'm hoping to be able to turn around relatively quickly, depending on how quickly the city gives me the information that I need. We are still working on our next monthly magazine. We're a monthly print publication now, and I'm working on some larger investigative pieces for next month. So yeah, find us on newsstands now. And thank you all for reading.
Gino, thank you. Thanks for the outstanding work that you and the team at City Newspaper and, of course, WXXI, proud to have that partnership. Thank you for the work and for coming on the program today.
Appreciate it, Evan. Thanks for having me.
We've got members of the Police Accountability Board with us. Shawnee Wilson, Danielle Tucker, Rabbi Dror Settle, and your phone calls. If you're on the line, Julian Fairport and others, I see the phone ringing. We'll take your phone calls and emails after our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, our final conversation in a series of conversations with local superintendents just days away from the start of school. What are they doing and what are they learning looking at school reopenings elsewhere as kids get ready to go back to the classroom next week? Then in our second hour, the Rochester Fringe Festival is going virtual this year. We'll hear from the festival's producer and some of the performers about how to do Fringe during the pandemic. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Julie in Fairport on the phone with us first. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi. This goes to lack of awareness. Maybe others had missed this on Weekend Edition, which is NPR on the weekend. Michael Bell Sr., you can look up the account of him, described the murder of his son, Michael Bell Jr., in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in 2004. The police pulled his son over for a DUI, put a pistol to his head, his temple, pulled the trigger. Police determined that the shooting was justified after only 2 days. Michael Bell Sr., the father, fought for 10 years to change the law so that an outside agency, not the police, investigate police shootings. So the law was changed in 2014. That's Michael Bell Sr. talking about his son, Michael Bell Jr., in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So I just wanted to add that in because I missed that. Maybe others had in the news. Okay, I'm going to hang up now. Thank you.
Julie, thank you. I appreciate that phone call and some of the history. And Shawnee Wilson, as the chair of the Police Accountability Board, it's been a long time coming for a PAB in Rochester. And part of Julie's point, when you look at the Bell case in Wisconsin and the years it takes to make change, is that something the community needs to accept, that these kinds of serious structural change takes time? Or do you think urgency is going to press it forward more quickly now?
So I think that's when we first started this hour, I actually wrote something down about, you know, since my background is medical, I wrote about like chemical changes, right? And we know that there are certain changes when a bunch of chemicals mix together that, you know, they just stay inert. But when you add a catalyst to that actual chemical react, it becomes a reaction, right? So I believe two things. I believe that, you know, there is, you know, this giant streamliner in the ocean that is still, you know, has to change little by little. But I also believe that with these catalysts that happen, that yes, these things do, it is propelled faster. You know, when you talked about earlier about, you know, needing, you know, some people in power, you know, we talked about like making sure that, you know, people are actually calling for change and actually seeing that change come forward. And, you know, I believe that there's, like I've said before on your program, that there are, you know, activists, that there are people that are young, that are ready to work, that are spirited, that are, you know, interested in change, that are being strategic about how to make those changes happen. And I believe that, you know, with, you know, the many organizations of the PABA that formed this board, that I believe that that is one indication of that change. You know, I think that these are things that have never been seen before. And I just, that is why I believe that the tide is changing. I really do.
Michael Huffman emails to say he doesn't like what he's hearing on the program today. He says, why don't you have a member of the RPD on a show like this? Or do you only have guests who agree with you? That's from Michael. Michael, a couple of points here. First of all, no one from the RPD is allowed to come on this program by direction of the mayor. Mayor Warren has not come back on this program since July of 2017, when she felt that I was unfair to her in an interview. And she has made it clear that she will not be back and that members of City Hall will not be on this program, and has made it clear that the police chief and members of RPD will not be on this program. That is the reality we live with. It's a disappointment to me, but I respect the mayor. It is her decision to make. I respect that decision. I would certainly be open to a conversation that might open the door to changing that, but that is just the reality. So if you're upset with me that the mayor or the police chief or members of RPD are not on this program, all I can tell you is that is not my choice, nor is it my preference. Now, on the idea that we only have people who agree with us, I think that is a sort of a facile view of a much more complex question. My views as an individual and as a resident of the city of Rochester are not really pertinent here, other than this. I want this community to thrive, and I want us to love and respect each other as best we can. As nebulous as that sounds, it's true. But beyond that, on policy, my views don't really matter here. And you shouldn't just reduce this to something very simple. What Shawnee Wilson and Danielle Tucker and Rabbi Settle and Daniel Ponder and Lewis Stewart and Adrian Hale are talking about is a wide range of possible solutions. And while they align closely on some ideas, they don't agree on everything. There's not just two ideas here. It's not just police were right or police were wrong or police shouldn't be disciplined or police should. This is complex here. Do you give a PAB disciplinary power? There are some who agree with the mayor and say no. And there are some who agree with those board members who are on the program today who say yes. Do you view certain actions that the police take as appropriate and mental health calls? And do you want to change that? There are some who say no, keep it in police hands. Others say change it. Do you want less policing or more? Look at the Gallup polling from just a month ago. 61% of Black Americans do not want less policing. 20% want more. 19% want less. That's 81% of Black Americans right now want the same or more policing. But the vast majority want better policing, want a change in how policing gets done. So it's complex. It's not just one idea here. So I just would challenge you on the idea that we only have guests who agree with me. I assure you that's not the case. That's not my preference, and it's not always that simple. That's all I would tell you there. Thanks for the email. Let me get back to your phone calls. Bonnie in Rochester next. Hi, Bonnie. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Two things. I'll repeat this one thing I've kind of been repeating often. When the people are right when they talk about racism and that there's not like a magic button, there's not 20 books you could read, it's a process. And it really is a lifelong process, especially since we haven't made, you know, the kind of progress already we'd like to make. It's, you know, better than maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And a lot of it's internalized. You know, the racism isn't just I woke up one day and I decide I'm going to be racist. No, it's the informal, it's the conditioning things that you don't always think about, and it's 10 other things. The only way you deal with that kind of stuff, and I think this is so, so important, is that one of the big proposals that people have locally been working on is this anti-racism education, which would go from first grade all the way to 12th and then, you know, be chopped up in ways that are, you know, age appropriate, everything. And it's an interactive, it's an interconnected process. It doesn't just, you know, say here's the anti-racism rule, and it, like most things in life, it interacts with things, with police, with the whole structured racism, and your own internalized, which is one of the biggest problems I think we have. People just don't either know how, which is understandable, to get in touch with, well, what is inside myself? That's a process. Okay, so that is absolutely critical. Number two, and I wasn't able to turn in the first hour, but I understand maybe some of the, you know, what happened in what time period on this issue was discussed, and I want to raise something that I don't know if this is a problem with this situation, but the man who was who died was at Strong. I don't know how long he was at Strong, and the reason I say that, I mean, you probably do, but by now, but is that, you know, for many years, the issue of mental health and people staying in the hospital for treatment, you know, one day, 2 day, 10 days, especially with, you know, private hospitals and stuff, is that who's going to pay? And so it often gets, and I used to work with people with disabilities and stuff who would be leaving the hospital, maybe they had nowhere to go, and they would just be released. That did get better because we pushed it. But nowadays, it's been, you know, a lot of the mental health stuff has been, by the state, has been kind of pushed aside to somebody else. I'm not saying all of it. But that's one of the issues that needs to be raised here, I think, is, you know, some people are saying just get, you know, some agency, you know, and that they name in Oregon or something to, you know, take over that piece. Well, the problem is that mental hygiene is a responsibility of the state of New York to provide services and to provide the money. That's where you need to look, because I don't know what if Strong, you know, he could should have stayed longer there. I don't know that. I totally admit it. But if you don't bring in the fact that the state of New York is responsible for the direction mental hygiene is going in, that's a better discussion with more power things behind it than let's just go talk to somebody who has a small agency in wherever, I'm making this up now, Connecticut or something. We need to make a much more powerful solution and tie some loose ends that have been loose one way or the other for a long time in this field. Thank you.
Bonnie, thank you. On that subject of mental health, there's a lot there. Shawnee Wilson, I'll start with you. What do you think?
So thank you so much, Bonnie, for bringing that up. I think that, you know, I've had a lot of experience with, you know, dealing with mental health in regards to the patients that I've had over the years. And, you know, I think in this particular case, what I will say is that, you know, I hope that the University of Rochester Medical Center will take a look at some of their policies in regards to how long they hold mental patients that are dealing with mental health issues. You know, I think you're right, you know, but to take it a step further and to say it is a state of New York issue, right? You know, if there was enough money to take care of people, if there were enough resources mental health providers, professionals, then we would see a change in the system. But, you know, I question whether or not that's been incentivized. You know, one of the things that Gino talked about in his article was about the FACET program, the Family Crisis Intervention Program. And over the years, I've worked with them a lot. And, you know, in 1977, he references that, you know, they had a total of 8 social workers. Today, it's 10 people. So only 10 people, you know, and that's, you know, and they take, you know, 3,500 calls a year per Gino's article. You know, I can attest to that, where I have friends that work in this program and they are running around the city and they're exhausted. How can 10 people service the mental health problems in an acute setting for an entire city? So, you know, I think that these programs need to be definitely, like Bonnie says, they need to be enhanced, expanded, and, you know, also working with places like the University of Rochester and also at the New York State level, pushing money into these programs to make sure that people can be safe, which you're now seeing is a huge problem.
The Daniel Prude story is now a CNN headline. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar is now tweeting about it. I mean, this is the national story that a lot of people thought it would be yesterday. And the question is, what reforms come? Well, speaking of reform, Amanda in Rochester wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Amanda.
Hi. I mean, I'm sure this is along the lines of what everyone's been saying, but I think that defund the police isn't really this monolithic point that everyone, like, you're either pro or you're anti. Defund the police can really encompass funding mental health and funding, you know, there's, you know, like, just, I don't know, I'm not even going to list off all the right things, but all of these community needs. And so for me personally, I evolved radically on the idea of defunding the police when I realized, or when I saw a presentation about all the things that could be funded with that same money. So I don't know. You know, for me, it made a really big difference to think about shifting the funds around, not just defunding the police, not just evaporating that money.
Sure. Yeah. Amanda, thank you. I mean, I think that's an important point. And Shawnee, I mean, in fact, I think all of our guests in our remaining time, let's build on Amanda's comment there, because to the rabbi's point, you know, this is not just a PAB about disciplinary power. It's about reform. Shawnee, how do you see that question about defunding and what money gets used to do what in the city?
Sure. So, you know, we talk about, you know, when I say, you know, I know people are, you know, Daniel Ponder put this perfectly, right? You know, I think that, you know, defunding versus, you know, reforming, reimagining, restructuring, and rearranging money to go towards some of these programs, like I said before in your program, you know, like the case in point with the FACET program, you know, we have all these resources, and yet, you know, there seems to be all this water everywhere, but everybody's dying from dehydration, right? So, you know, we need to make sure that these actually make sure that these programs are actually getting funded. And if we know that there are, if we know that there, you know, the police are having all these calls, like, you know, Baxter talked about, you know, 911 addiction, you know, then we need to make sure that these programs are in place to make sure people can actually get help in real time instead of waiting for the police to function and function in five or six different roles.
Daniel Tucker, how do you see that question? You might be on mute, Danielle, if you're there. A lot of our guests do that.
Hi, yes. Sorry, yeah, I was okay. On mute. It wouldn't allow me to take
there you
my
go.
Phone off of mute. Can you repeat the question?
Well, just how you see the reprioritization of funding and, you know, the question on defunding versus possible reforms and what it means.
Yes, defunding and the possible reforms. I believe the topic gives us a chance to look at exactly what defunding is. I think now a lot of people are unaware what exactly people mean when we say defunding. At times when we think defunding police, I think a lot of people think get rid of the police and not actually understanding that it just means reallocating or redirecting funding away from the police department to other government agencies. With the death of Daniel Prude, and we see how it was a mental health, a mental hygiene arrest, we can see, you know, that's an agency that could probably use money and, you know, and benefit from the defunding and reallocating those funds. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. I think as a whole, we have to educate ourselves on what we may find is the best for us to go in the right direction.
Danielle Tucker, Rabbi Settle, Shawnee Wilson from the Rochester Police Accountability Board joining us to say as much as they can about the Daniel Prude case, but also looking ahead, the implications for their work to come. Thanks to all three of you for making the time, and let's continue these conversations soon. All right, listeners, we've got a lot to talk about in the days to come about this case and more, and we want to bring in as wide a range of voices as possible, and we intend to do that here. We'll take your feedback as well, connections@wxxi.org. Let us know how you think we're doing. Rob Braden, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson, thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.